Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
You're done with your Oreo?
Yeah, done with my Oreo.
Okay, good.
Do you really know what happened?
The brother did.
The brother, that's what I thought too!
I mean, that seems like kind of obvious.
Hey, do you want to talk about death?
Yeah. I mean, I...
Mystery, murdery, thingy, 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 thingy.
Okay. Go, go, go. Go, go.
Okay.
Here we go.
We are relaxed today.
No, we're not. We're high energy. We're pumped up.
We've got some good stories.
Yes. Welcome to Mystery Murdery Thingy. My name is Mario.
My name is Chloe.
How's it going?
Hey.
What's up?
I don't know what that was.
No, we don't do that anymore.
It's Bad Albert. Okay.
Yeah, we don't do that anymore.
What? You don't remember Fat Albert?
No, but I
loved
do.
It,
but,
didn't you?
But it was Bill Cosby, so we don't do that anymore.
Ew.
Indeed.
I didn't know that.
Oh, really? Yeah. Sorry to ruin Fat Albert for everybody.
Or maybe I did know that, but I've like. Never mind.
Sure.
Out of my mind.
We'll move on.
I have such a good one today.
And you're going second, so we'll look forward to that. Try to pay attention during my
meager mystery.
Okay, so I'm doing another mobster mystery today. So I'm going to cover the mystery-filled life and very mysterious death of the man known as Johnny Roselli. Which we'll talk about in just a moment, but I should just preface by saying that it should come as no surprise that the ever-present in our mobster stories, Al Capone, will make an appearance before too long. So don't worry, but we'll get there. But we'll start
Al.
I know our friend Al, so to speak. But we're gonna start many, many thousands of miles away from Al Capone. In the small dirt streets of a tiny Italian community called Ispedia in 1905. Oh. And in that town, on July 4th, 1905, wow. America's Independence Day, a young boy named Filippo Sacco was born. This boy would eventually become one of the most famous mobsters in America and almost completely erase all trace of his humble beginnings in rural Italy.
Wow.
From almost anyone knowing about it for most of his life, which is just kind of crazy. So, yeah. At six, though, little Filippo and his mother, Marantonio, joined his father, Vincenzo, in the United States, moving to the Boston suburb of Somerville, Massachusetts in 1911. And they're part of this huge, huge wave, right, of mostly Southern Italians moving to the United States over many, many, many years because of, you know, deprivation and oppression, et cetera, et cetera. So Filippo's sort of transformation into the cryptic criminal that he would become, his sort of Breaking Bad moment, so to speak, to use a topical reference from fucking 10 years ago, would start with something very sad, actually. The tragic death of his beloved father, Vincenzo Sacco, in 1918 when he was about 12, 13 years old. And according to the sources that I read, Vincenzo was a very loving father and husband. He treated, you know, his family and his wife and everything with fairness, with love and care. So it's really sad that actually that he passed away so early. And it's kind of sad, I think, to think about how things may have turned out differently, right, for Filippo Sacco, Johnny Roselli, you know, if his father hadn't succumbed to the Spanish flu, which is how he died, actually, in the 1918 Spanish flu, which, just side notes, the Spanish flu was one of the deadliest disasters in all of human history that we know of, killing an estimated 3 to 5% of the Earth's population.
Yeah.
About 50 to 100 million people, infecting up to 500 million worldwide.
It's fucked up.
And it was, within that, you know, pandemic that Filippo's father died. And with his father gone and his mother left to tend to him and his, you know, few siblings that they had had by then, Filippo started looking out for himself. He stopped going to school. He figured he was done with that. You know, he's passed whatever, seventh grade. That's enough school. And starts, you know, as so many kids were doing then, who had become, you know, orphaned or single parents, just started kind of finding their way on the street, right? Fending for themselves, getting into some petty crimes. And at this time, according to Johnny Roselli, quoted in the Lee Server book, that was kind of my main source, Massachusetts was the first state to require school attendance, but no one really seemed to mind that Johnny Roselli, you know, just never went back to school, ever. Apparently his mom, he found out later that his mom actually found out, and she just, like, didn't tell him or mention it. Just never mentioned it.
So she didn't really care?
Well, she had other siblings, and it wasn't out of the norm necessarily at the time. Like, this whole idea of being compelled to go to school was still a little bit new. So, you know, it wasn't that weird. Uh-huh. And as many young children at the time were trying to do as well, because I think this kind of plays into it, he was looking to bring in a little money, right, to his family.
Right,
because
right.
The main breadwinner, like, his mom hadn't worked before.
Yeah.
It was just his dad, who'd been making a pretty good, you know, good salary for them, but, you know, now he's gone. This kind of is what led the beginnings of his life in crime. And eventually, Filippo's criminal interest landed him in some serious, quote-unquote, heat. Right? Mob term? It's good, right?
Yeah, good job.
Awesome, cool. Including actually setting his stepdad's butcher shop on fire. Intentionally,
what?
In an insurance scam. His stepdad came to him and was like, hey, son. And his stepdad didn't treat him great to begin with. But was like, hey, you know, son, oh, I need you. You need to do this for the family, you know, and I need to get out of these debts. And he put this on this, like, kid, like 14, 15-year-old kid, and he did it. And apparently they got away with it and got a bunch of money out of it. Yeah. But he had to get out of Dodge, you know, in this case, Dodge being Boston. And this started his kind of wanderings for a time. So Johnny, as he would come to be known, returned briefly to New York, where he had just transited through, right, many years before from Ellis Island, and made friends with a young Italian drifter, fellow drifter, named Tancredi Tortora. Tancredi Tortora. That's how the guy says it in the in the audiobook of the Johnny Roselli. Tancredi Tortora. Who
sounds musical.
I know, right. It's Italian, so of course it sounds musical. Who would, decades later, become the man who would reveal the secret of his real identity, of Johnny Roselli's real identity, many, many, many years later to the FBI, actually. Johnny, he, you know, they're bumming around, they're having fun, but they're also catching more heat. In New York, of course, which is where, in New York, which is, that's terrible, which is where this pseudonym of Johnny Roselli came to be, where he kind of thought of this. And it was apparently in honor of the Italian Renaissance sculptor Cosimo Roselli, who had worked on the Sistine Chapel.
So that's where he got,
apparently he was looking through the encyclopedia, trying to find an American, Italian-sounding name, and thought, hey, John Roselli, great.
That works.
Exactly, and it did for the remainder of his life. So from this point on, almost no one but his close family and a few very trusted associates in Boston knew that Johnny Roselli was actually Filippo Sacco. And, like I said, it would come out, you know, sort of like 40 plus years later, but it's crazy that he kind of kept the secret.
Was he still alive when it came out?
Yes. Oh. And he was confronted with it toward the end of his life. Which we'll get to before too long, because like I told you earlier, I'm going to do kind of like early life, later life, and we're going to cut out like everything in the middle, because there's just like way too much to talk about. So yeah, at the end of the, 19-teens and the beginning of the 20s, the roaring 20s, Roselli and Tortora traveled across the country, taking menial and manual labor jobs, getting into trouble. They, you know, would change their names, their occupations, always kind of shifting around, but they focused on some very key areas, making some dough, getting some girls, and having some fun.
Fuck bitches, get money.
That was their life. They were beginning to be gangsters, living the gangster life in a small way. But as so many things do, eventually Tortora and Filippo's, Johnny's friendship came to an end. They parted ways, and Johnny stayed in L.A., Los Angeles, where they had eventually gotten to, right? Can't go any further. Mm-hmm. And immediately, when Johnny got there, he was just, like, enamored of the sunshine and the general lawlessness of Los Angeles at the time. Apparently, the police were just, like, super corrupt at this point in Los Angeles.
God.
Like, super-duper corrupt. while Tortora fed his wanderlust and moved on, never to meet Johnny Roselli again. Meanwhile, the crafty and congenial, very, very nice, amicable Johnny Roselli was endearing himself to some of the most powerful and rich people on the underworld of L.A. And even some not in the underworld. A trend that would continue throughout his whole life. He always made friends. Everyone always liked him. They always spoke well of him, said he was a gentleman. If they weren't in the mob, they didn't necessarily know he was in the mob. Because he didn't necessarily give off that vibe, which is weird, but it's like something came up like all the time in regards to him. And he also eventually earned the nickname Handsome Johnny, because he was a lifelong bachelor, minus a very brief wedding to a movie star for about a year. But he had numerous love interests throughout his entire life, and many of them were in their 20s, when he was far away from his 20s. He was also eventually known as the Silver Fox. But I doubt he originated that name. I mean, come on, but I don't know, maybe. Johnny worked his way into being employed and into the good graces of the mafia, such as it was in Los Angeles at the time. Because apparently it was pretty low stakes there in Los Angeles. And in the furthermore, in the power politics of the early 1920s, Los Angeles, like within the sort of underworld, right, the sort of white people mob, as you might, you know, say, were sort of had the in with the police, and they were the big, the big cheese. There in Los Angeles at the time, while the smaller outfits, like, you know, this offshoot of the Italian mafia, were kind of sidelined. And there were, like, a bunch of other ones, smaller ones, too. Nevertheless, Johnny and his employers and compatriots managed to earn a pretty good living doing what they called rum running.
Okay.
Not necessarily rum. That was kind of, like, anachronistic or whatever. Mostly high-end whiskey. Canadian whiskey was coming from Canada. Gin, you
during
know.
During the Prohibition.
Prohibition, exactly. Johnny's first, this was kind of Johnny's first foray into the sort of like covert ops that we'll come back to later, in a sort of complex scheme of this illicit booze delivery, right, that involved taking these, like, really large ships out of ports in Canada, just, like, thousands and thousands of bottles and you know, in them. And of course, the liquor was legal in Canada, so they could just do this out in the open, right? And then they would go out to a pre-appointed point out in the ocean, at least 20 miles offshore, because it had to be in international waters. And then they would take a bunch of small boats all the way out there and shuttle hundreds or even thousands sometimes of small sacks, carrying a few bottles each, in each sack, all the way to shore, and then coming back and taking more. And this would take hours.
That's booze delivery.
Yeah, this was, like, serious. Crazy. Sometimes it took all night, and they were doing this, you know, even as dawn was breaking. And sometimes the waters were bad, you know, and it would be pretty dangerous. Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, some people lost their lives doing this.
What would you do for liquor? Damn.
Not that.
Not that.
Not that. And this was usually sufficient to, you know, get away with it, right? To not attract the attention of the police
right,
too much.
Yeah.
And again, at the beginning, there really wasn't that much attention to begin with. But as time went on, the heat increased generally in L.A. So, meanwhile, on a trip to Chicago, and this was, like, maybe the mid to later 20s, Johnny met the infamous Al Capone, making his grand entrance. Of course, at this time, he was already, or maybe this was right before he became, the head of the Chicago outfit. The biggest, you know, I guess, along with New York, mafia organization. And they started talking, like so many people. Capone was, you know, kind of taken with Johnny Roselli for his, you know, wit and charm and whatever he had.
Impressed.
Right. He was impressed. And eventually he asked Johnny to be his intermediary for the Chicago outfit to the Los Angeles wing of the mafia. So he was sort of like Capone's messenger. But more than that, you know, that sort of messenger implies a low. I mean, he was there to give the orders, you know, in the voice of Al Capone.
He was his connect.
Right. Exactly.
To that area of the country.
Yeah.
His
contact. Exactly. And this was to the man who was running the L.A. wing of the mafia, Jack Dragna, a man that Johnny already knew quite well and worked for and whom, you know, Johnny also liked, and liked him. And over the next many years, Johnny Roselli would ingratiate himself with seemingly everyone in Los Angeles. The leaders of the Italian mafia, both in Chicago and L.A., the people who own and ran the major and minor studios in L.A., even the censors who reviewed the movies for Appropriate Contact, one of them became one of his best friends for the rest of his life. And many of the major film stars who acted in the movies, including the Rat Pack. he was really good friends with Frank Sinatra, actually. And Johnny would also eventually legitimately produce some movies and become, like, in some ways a movie producer, like three of them or something, through this small production company called Eagle Lion Studios.
Ooh, that's...
It's kind of a weird name.
Yeah.
I don't really get it, but anyway. He would also help to extort money from all of the studios, major and minor, through a clandestine takeover of one of the major production unions. And he was involved in many, many other dubious, sneaky, and at the time mysterious, but later found out, doings over the decades.
Was he ever in Vegas?
Oh, yes. Major in Vegas.
I wonder if he brushed shoulders with Bugsy Siegel.
Well, it's funny you say that, because some people, I don't know, remember if you mentioned this in the episode, think that Jack Dragna was the man who put the hit out on Bugsy Siegel. actually. But no, he knew Bugsy Siegel. They knew each other through the mafia and everything like that. But other than that, I don't know of too many other connections. Bugsy was definitely mentioned in the book that I listened to, though.
Yeah, because they were operating around the same area. Like, Bugsy went to L.A. for a while, to California before going to...
Right, as so many people did to get away from the heat. In the East, it's like, it's a thing. Like, it comes up all the time.
Yeah. That's actually and then exactly Vegas why. Later. He was literally something, I think his life was in danger. And yeah. So he literally was like, go to Vegas. His boss was like, go to Vegas.
But it's so funny you say that, because actually, I wasn't going to talk about it too much, but Johnny Roselli basically was one of the, in a way, people who, like, made Vegas what it was in those early days. Like, he helped to facilitate, like, opening some of the casinos. He helped... He was actually really key in selling a bunch, at least, you know, a few casinos to Howard Hughes, which kind of, like, changed the nature of Vegas, like, for all time. No, he is huge in Vegas. But those are the kind of things that you can really dig into if you listen to this audiobook or read the book, which I would definitely recommend.
What's it called?
Handsome Johnny, The Life and Death of Johnny Roselli, and it's by Lee Server, and it came out last year in 2018. But if I went through, like, even half of the stuff that Lee Server goes through, we'd be here forever. So I'm going to fast forward. And we're going to fast forward to 1960, okay? And picture it. Cuba.
Picture it.
Cuba. We've been watching a lot of Golden Girls lately.
Yeah.
Cuba, 1960. Fidel Castro is 1 year into his rule, and there are plots galore to do him in. And one of these, we found out years later... in the 70s, involved a secret alliance between the CIA and the American Mafia.
Classic.
Right, so this is 1960, and the point of contact was an ex-FBI agent acting as a so-called cutout for the CIA named Robert Mayhew. A cutout is an informal representative for usually an intelligence service. It might be a diplomat... might be an academic. It's someone who doesn't officially work for the CIA or MI6 or whomever, right?
But somebody who does research for them or something.
Well, someone who acts as a spy for them.
Oh.
But it's not. It's on the down low.
Oh.
It's secret. It's like spy shit.
It's...
like, okay. Literally spy shit. So, yeah, that was Robert Mayhew. And Mayhew was ostensibly retired from the government, but secretly, like I said, not so much. So at some point, some people at the CIA thought it would be a great idea to get rid of Fidel Castro, right?
Hi!
And for anyone who may be surprised to hear this, first of all, read a book. Secondly...
Mario!
I know, right? I'm being such a bitch. Secondly, listen to our two-parter on all of the crazy shit that the CIA was getting up to, like, especially in its early years,
like episodes
49 and 50. Yeah, 49 and 50. I looked it up. Mayhew approached Johnny Roselli for this very sensitive proposition, you know, in 1960. And because he knew Johnny, you know, to be both a man deeply involved with the mafia, who they believed could do this, but also a reasonable and reasonably honorable man, which is a fairly rare combination, as you can imagine, right?
Yeah. Well, that's what it seemed like when you were talking about how, like, oh, he was so well-liked and this, that, and the other thing.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And it wasn't really a bias, it seemed. It seemed like he genuinely was well-liked.
Right, exactly. People seemed to just be taken with him and almost forgive him for the, you know, or not look too closely at his other side. So, yeah, Johnny... took the deal. He said he wasn't going to take the money that was offered, which was several hundred thousand dollars at the time.
I'll take that.
But he said out of patriotic duty, he would take the job.
Okay.
And yes, it might sound a little contrived or whatever, hokey, but it should be noted that Johnny Roselli did also enlist in the army during World War II when he was 36 years old, and he was not going to be drafted.
Oh, wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and despite him having lifelong health issues, and he actually served for a few years. Yeah, and then he was given an other than honorable discharge when he was arrested, one of the many times he was arrested.
What's other than honorable?
Other than honorable, it's like not honorable, you know, it's like... you didn't do something really bad, I guess, so it's not dishonorable, but it's also not honorable because it's not just like you got out because you wanted to. I don't really know. I'm not too sure. But, yeah, Johnny had gathered a small, you know, after he accepted the deal, right, the hit, he gathered a small team of trusted mobsters and set about trying to actually engineer the assassination of Fidel Castro. God. Again, not the only team working on this at the time. They prepared. They planned. They honestly kind of dithered after a while. Eventually, the government supplied them with some poison pills to be secreted to Havana and put in Fidel's food.
Yeah.
But
failed.
It failed. And all of their attempts failed.
Right.
One of them quite disastrously, apparently, according to Johnny, to the point that the would-be assassins, the four of them, were found out and tortured by the Castro regime. Possibly also there may have been an attempt to turn them so that they would, you know, conduct a hit for the Cubans, possibly tying this, of course, inevitably into the killing of President Kennedy.
This goes deep.
It goes super deep. And there are definitely, like, conspiracy theories about connections between JFK's murder and Johnny Roselli on both sides. Which is funny, but, you know, it's conspiracy theory. So this, and it, yeah, so it went really, really wrong.
Went really, really wrong.
It wasn't great. So, yeah, this and at least one other attempt by the mafia-led effort to oust Castro were unsuccessful, and eventually they just abandoned the whole idea. And they thought that it had been buried in the secret history of the CIA, but of course that was not to be, because
the secret history of the CIA.
Yeah, well, the secret history of the CIA was made public in 2007, so it's like been officially confirmed that this happened, was known as part of Operation Mongoose, which was this sort of effort to oust Castro, right? And then it was also detailed in a behind-the-closed couple of congressional hearings by Johnny Roselli. And this was his testimony to the church committee, it came to be known, which was investigating sort of like all of the out-of-control intelligence stuff that had been going on like for all time. And this was after Watergate, right? So this was June 24th and September 22nd, 1975. Johnny goes before the Senate. And at this point, he's in his 70s. He's telling what he knows, right? Not the only time he went before the Senate. He was also brought back before the Senate again on April 23rd, 1976, to talk about what he knew about the Kennedy assassination. Johnny had congressional hearing. Johnny had some idea. He had heard some rumors to the effect that, as I mentioned earlier, some of the assassins pointed at Castro may have been turned and redirected back to kill Kennedy. And this may have really been what was going on with the Kennedy assassination. Now, I should be quick to point out that this was purely hearsay, that there was no evidence for this, and that Johnny himself, while saying this, was telling them this was a rumor that he had heard that he himself was not completely convinced of. And they brought it up because they knew this was kind of going around, right? But all of that is kind of a mystery for another day, right? Someday maybe we'll do the Kennedy assassination. It's fucking a huge thing, obviously. So
it's just so political, and I think it's a lot just of so it's much. Confusing.
So anyway, unbeknownst to him and to the senators and whomever, Johnny's untimely demise was fast approaching. At the time, like I said before, he was in his early 70s, and he was honestly trying to retire. I mean, really, he was trying to go straight, but really this time. Like, of course, he had had these before, right? But really this time. And he was living with his sister and her husband in Florida. He read a lot. He watched TV. He sat by the pool. He didn't do anything shady. And he was being watched closely by the FBI at the time. Other than meet once in a while with the local head mafioso to pay his respects, which he felt like he had to do.
On July 28th, Johnny took his sister's car for a drive, not telling her where he was going. Now, this in and of itself was not that unusual, and she let him use his car, her car, whenever. But when Johnny didn't come back that night or the next day, they were, you know, starting to get pretty worried and contacted the police. They eventually start a search. They find her car parked at the park, parked at the airport parking lot, but essentially no evidence found on it. They thought, well, maybe he's gone on some urgent piece of business that we don't know about. I mean, he's a mysterious guy, right? They don't know everything that he's getting up to. However, any suspicion was put to rest, tragically, when on August 9th of 1976, a 55-gallon steel drum was found floating by some fishermen in the weirdly named Dumbfounding Bay near Miami. Dumbfounding Bay. Very eerie, I think. So from the smell and the circumstance, they thought this was probably a body. When the police opened the drum, they found that this was correct. The body was highly decomposed. The legs, of Johnny Roselli's body, you know, Filippo Sacco's body, had been dismembered and were stuffed next to it in order for the whole body to be put into the drum. And this was eventually, like I said, ID'd as Johnny Roselli. So for some time, friends and family had been urging Johnny to get out of Miami, to get out of sight, to get out of the danger that they knew was coming for him. But he refused to acknowledge this. He just didn't think that it existed. He didn't think he was in any danger. He thought, well, I'm retired. Who's going to try to kill me? Like, I don't have any enemies.
Yikes.
Obviously not true. Now, it seemed to them that the danger had caught up with him. Now, from where? Some thought maybe it was the CIA cleaning up its mess. Not too plausible for a number of reasons. Or maybe it was a rogue Cuban agent looking for revenge for the attempted assassination of Castro. Again, fairly implausible. Most think that it had something to do with the mafia. Possibly the fact that Johnny Roselli didn't clear his Senate testimony with the mafia higher-ups, and they thought, you know, he may have given info that he shouldn't have. Wait, and so broken the code of silence, omerta, so, as the mafia calls
it.
So
he had to, like, go to the higher-ups and be like, hello, am I allowed to retire? Something like that?
More the testimony before the Senate, because they knew that the Senate was going to ask him about stuff, other mobsters and stuff, right? So what you're supposed to do if you don't want to get killed is to go, you know, to whoever's the local, you know, Don, and say, hey, you know, I got a subpoena. I have to go before the Senate, but, like, what should I do? And they probably tell him, like, you don't say shit. You say shit, you're dead. And he's like, but I'm going to go to jail. And they're like, yeah, you say shit, you're dead. And then he does whatever he's going to do. You know, and that's how it goes. Like, it gets super fucking real. He avoided that, and he thought, well, I'm a smart guy. I'm not going to really tell them anything. And the mafia, they'll know that I'm not really going to tell them anything, but maybe they didn't know.
Okay, that's right. Possible.
But we also don't really know what did happen, right? Because there was no trace of a real investigation I could find. No suspects were ever arrested. No one was ever charged. Our best shot at sort of the truth, I think, comes from a contemporaneous New York Times article by Nicholas Gage. This came out like several months after the murder had occurred. And it purports to be what really happened. I don't know whether it is or not, but it's certainly the best story I heard of what really happened. And okay, I'm going to read kind of an extended quote here from this article from 1977, I think, by Nicholas Gage, New York Times. The mafia figure said that shortly after Mr. Roselli's first appearance before the Senate committee on June 24th, 1975, his murder was approved by the Commission of Bosses that sets policy for the 26 mafia families in the country. Several members of the commission had wanted Mr. Roselli killed since the Frontier Hotel case, and when the rest learned that he testified before the Senate committee, they decided he would just go on talking every time he was pressured, and he had to be hit, the mafia figure said.
On July 28th, Mr. Roselli and his sister ate a late brunch, and then at 12:50 p.m., he left in her car, a silver 1975 Chevrolet Impala. He gave no hint of having an appointment, and she assumed he would be back soon. What happened then was described by the unnamed mafia figure. Mr. Roselli drove to a marina and went aboard a private boat, where he was received by two men, one an old friend, the other a visitor from Chicago. The boat put off, and a third man on shore drove the Roselli car to the Miami International Airport, where it was later found. While Mr. Roselli was sipping a glass of vodka, the man from Chicago grabbed him from behind and held his hand tightly over Mr. Roselli's nose and mouth until he was asphyxiated. Not a difficult feat, because Mr. Roselli had emphysema. Oh. Within an hour after he got on the boat, he was dead, the mafia figure said. Aboard the boat was an empty metal oil drum, 36 inches high and 22 inches in diameter, with a number of holes cut into it so that it would fill with water and sink. A cannon washcloth was taped tightly over Mr. Roselli's mouth to make sure he was dead. Then his legs were sawed off so that the body could be stuffed into the drum. To lift the body into the oil drum, the men tied a rope around the neck and stuck a tow hook into each side of the abdomen just under the ribs. While one man hoisted the body with the rope, the other lifted with the two hooks. When the torso was finally lowered into the drum, the legs were stuffed in with it, and heavy iron chains were laced through the holes in the drum, around the body, and over the lid of the drum. Close quote. Quite gruesome.
They hooked him.
But it speaks, I think, and again, just like always, we talk about the gruesome details because they're important to know what happened, and because it helps you to figure out exactly what happened. It sounds like a mafia hit, in my completely uninformed opinion.
I know, right?
allegedly, more than anything else, right? And this seems like a very plausible story as to what happened. But again, I'm not endorsing any view because we don't know. That's the thing about a mystery, which is so great. Johnny Roselli's death remains very much mysterious, as do, some other of the stories, and some others are just fascinating from his life. So, again, just encourage, pick up read or listen to Handsome Johnny and by Lee Server. My other sources were Nicholas Gage at the New York Times, Christopher Yogerst at the Washington Post, Mafia Wiki, the Johnny Roselli page, Wikipedia, of course, Seth Ferranti at Vice.
Wow.
Where did you say that comes from?
The episode Harry Potter Puppet Pals.
Oh.
Wizard Swears.
Right, exactly.
He says
on the YouTubes.
Elder Swear.
Right.
And Ron goes, wow.
It's good.
So now I just say it all the time. Okay, everybody. Get ready for the... Okay, I have a hell of a story this week, you guys. Let's talk about Treva Thornberry, not Thornberry.
Okay. Thornberry. Yep.
Yes.
I've heard that name before.
Really? Thornberry?
Yeah.
It's my first time hearing it. So, our story begins in Electra, Texas, 1985. Texas, Mario, Texas.
Oh, Texas.
Treva Thornberry was 16 years old when she disappeared. She's described as having brown hair and freckles. She was quiet and polite. She was a waitress at the local drive-in hamburger restaurant called The Whistle Stop. She played tennis and she read the Bible. She was normal. She didn't even drink or smoke cigarettes like all the other girls in town.
Well, bully for her.
Treva
was... Oh, wait, something terrible's going to happen to her, isn't it? Sorry.
I'm saying nothing.
Sorry.
Treva was still a little weird. Quote, one day at school, she drew a picture of a young girl standing under a leafless tree, her face blue, the sun black. One Sunday at the Pentecostal church, she stumbled to the front altar, fell to her knees, and began telling Jesus that she didn't deserve to live. And then there was that day when Treva's young niece, Jalisha, who was awake the previous night and whispered that a man was... Oops, sorry, no, wait. Young niece Jaleesha, who was staying at the Thronberry home, told people that Treva had shaken her awake the previous night and whispered that a man was outside her room with a gun, which turned out to be not true at all. End quote. That December of 1985, Treva stopped showing up at up to work and school. She seemed to just vanish. So, Electra was a pretty small country town in Texas, right? So the news spread pretty quickly. There was talk that Treva had been last seen at the police station, where she gave a statement claiming that her dad had raped her at gunpoint and her mother had left when she found out. A police officer, you know, they heard this. A police officer called child welfare. Child welfare sent a social worker to Electra to take Treva away. And a judge entered emergency protection orders temporarily preventing Treva's parents, Carl and Patsy Thronberry, from seeing their daughter or even finding out where she was being taken. Carl and Patsy were described as really normal little town country folk, right? So they had five children, one son and four daughters, Treva being the youngest. And, you know, they admit they had trouble making ends meet sometimes, but they always made sure that the kids were fed and dressed properly. In court, Carl and Patsy insisted that Treva wasn't telling the truth. Both older sisters also, or the three older sisters also gave affidavits saying that their father was innocent as well. The attorney wanted Treva to even take a lie detector test. Carl accused the members of Electra's Pentecostal church. He was like, if Treva was raped, it was the crazy people over at the Pentecostal church. Turns out Treva had been going there for comfort and saying that she was scared to be at home. And she said that she had been sneaking out at night to sleep in a pew at the church. Treva also had odd behaviors at the foster home that she was then taken to. Her foster mother, Sharon Gentry, talked about how gentle and polite Treva was, but noticed her one night curled in the fetal position and like banging her head against the wall, and she was like, she was punishing herself or something like that. So she's living in a foster home, and she begins she began attending Wichita Falls High School, and you know, she was a good and thoughtful student. She diligently read her Bible, usually kept to herself. And she started leaving notes in various places for Sharon to find. Really kind of dark ones. Quote, "Sometimes I wish I were dead. Sometimes I don't. Life seems impossible and death seems eternal. I will have no life after death." End quote. She also told Sharon a story about how back in her hometown of Electra, she had been kidnapped and taken blindfolded to an abandoned oil field where members of a satanic cult tied her to a stake, and then she said that people in black robes were like dancing all around her, and that they slit the throats of black cats and dogs and made her drink the blood. Your face is describe your face to me right now.
Dubious.
Correct. So she also opened up to her school counselor, told her about how she had suicidal thoughts. In May of 1986, Treva was handcuffed and taken to Wichita Falls State Hospital. She became very depressed, often seen crying. She rarely ate. She was often by herself. They prescribed Xanax for anxiety and Trilofan, which was designed to combat what they called thought disorders, and an antidepressant by the name of Tofranil. During this time, she wrote a few letters to her foster mother, Sharon, as well to a boy that she liked at the time. Doctors described her condition. They put it as a characterological disorder. Characterological disorder. Yeah. Yes. So I didn't know what characterology was. I was like, what? So basically it sounds obvious. It's a study of character, but usually in regards to how we develop as humans and how our childhood trauma affects who we are as an adult. One therapist wrote, quote, she's kind of quiet and secretive and she may have a personality problem, end quote. The DA's office dismissed the charges against her father, Carl, due to lack of evidence. Trevor then met with her parents, but in the presence of a therapist and a social worker. So this is what, this is after, she had been gone for a while. The parents told her to admit that she had been lying, and Trevor completely refused. She called her parents liars. She said that they didn't love her and that she had nothing more to say to them, and she just left. Trevor was discharged from the state hospital in October of 1986, about 5 months later. She didn't want to go live with her parents, and her parents didn't want her there either, unless she were to recant her statement. So she was sent to a troubled adolescent home in Fort Worth called Lena Pope Home. So there was, she started working with therapists to improve her behavior. She enrolled in Arlington Heights High School so she could finish her senior year. She graduated in June of 1987. At this point, she also turned 18 and by law couldn't be under state juvenile supervision. So she started making plans to be on her own. She said that she wanted to apply to a Bible college that didn't require an SAT score. And she said she just wanted to feel normal and live a full life. She did go back to Electra for about a day, only to visit her sisters, her three sisters, Carlene, Kim, and Sue. This is where things get dark. So they really wanted her to come back home, back to Electra, but they also understood why she couldn't. All four girls had been sexually assaulted by their uncle, Billy Ray. Billy Ray is Carl's older brother, who they're like best friends. He adores his older brother, right? And so Billy Ray actually visited quite often. He would take them for a ride in his car to the store. And if they protested, their dad would say that, hey, you're being impolite. And that they should, quote, let Uncle Billy buy them something nice, end quote. Jesus. Yeah, he would like give them gifts and shit. Carlene, Kim, and Sue gave formal statements long after their uncle had died, talked about how he would sneak into their rooms at night. Quote, we had tried to let Mama and Daddy know what he was doing, at least we thought we had, but we didn't come out and say anything outright because Billy Ray had told us that if we ever did, he'd have Mama and Daddy killed, and then he'd have us all to himself. What were we supposed to do? We thought, and I know this sounds terrible, that this was the way things worked and that this was how everyone lived, end quote. Mm. So this was like small town mid-80s, yeah. Right? So people didn't talk about these things.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's that, you know, not that it only happens in small towns, but I feel like being separated from other people. Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, in any time, you know, it's like, it makes it easier if you're in any kind of cloistered environment.
Yeah.
You know.
So the girls, they did everything they could to stay away from home and stay away from their uncle. They, like, worked double shifts at their jobs. They stayed after school. They even got married young and moved out pretty quickly. And Trevor was left alone, and so she became Billy's favorite. So Trevor only spent a day visiting Electra, and after that, she was rarely heard from. She never did go to college. She lived briefly in the Fort Worth area with a woman who was raising three children, and supposedly she went to go live at a YWCA. Her foster mother, Sharon Gentry, received a collect phone call from Trevor once, and Trevor told her that she was working at a rundown motel in Arlington. She called again sometime later and said she was living on the streets, and then she disappeared. Years passed, and no one heard from Trevor Thornberry. Many assumed that she had been killed. Vancouver, Washington, 1997. 16-year-old Brianna Stewart was the new girl at Evergreen High School. She had been living in Portland, Oregon, just across the Columbia River from Vancouver for almost a year. She was walking the streets during the day and sleeping in grim youth shelters at night. She attended services at Glad Tidings Church, where she met a young couple who took her in. The couple believed that Brianna was full of potential and determined to succeed, so they enrolled her in the 10th grade at Evergreen High School. Greg Merrill, the school counselor, asked Brianna about her past, and she said she had been raised outside Mobile, Alabama by her mother and Navajo stepfather, who was also a sheriff's deputy. She also told the counselor that her mother had been murdered when she was a child, and so she lived with her stepfather. She ran away when she was 13, hitchhiked to the Northwest because her mother told her that her real father lived somewhere in the Northwest. And so that's why she was there. She wanted to find clues about her past. Brianna Stewart, she was enrolled at Evergreen High School. She became a bright student who loved school, usually came to school in a t-shirt, overalls, and pigtails. She carried with her a tennis racket and a Bible that she loved to read. She was a classic teenage wallflower. One day, she met Ken Dunn in Algebra 1 class. He started to talk to his friends about how much he liked her, and he was impressed at how smart she was, and he liked her Southern accent and how she knew so much about the Bible. And so he starts escorting her to class, and then they start exchanging flirtatious notes in algebra class. And so then he starts taking Brianna on little dates in his 1978 brown El Camino his friends called the Turd Tank.
That's great.
I know. So Brianna didn't usually talk about her past, but eventually she opened up to Ken. She told him about how she watched her father stab her mother to death and carry the body away. She said that he then made tapes of himself and his friends raping her, which he sold on the black market. She became pregnant at the age of 11 or 12, and Travis said her stepfather pushed her down a flight of stairs to force her to miscarry. When she went to the police, no one believed her, and she fled before being sent back home to her stepfather. She also talked about how earlier that summer she had gotten to know a security guard who worked in downtown Vancouver. She tells Ken about how the two of them were sitting in his car one day when he forced her to pull down her pants and he ended up raping her. Quote from Ken, quote, "Here was this beautiful girl who had been forced to endure unimaginable atrocities, and yet here she was at Evergreen, wanting to make something of herself in life. I wanted to help. I wanted to make her happy. I wanted her to know that someone cared for her." End quote. Later, he took her as his date to the Sadie Hawkins dance, where they wore matching blue overalls and shared their first kiss. Brianna Stewart became more well-known by the fall of 98, her junior year. She ended up going to the police and reporting the security guard who raped her. He pled guilty to, quote, "communicating with a minor for immoral purposes," end quote. At this point, Brianna starts to focus on her future and having a normal life. She wants to become a lawyer, focusing on children's issues. She expresses how she wants to find out more about her past, and she also wanted a social security number so she could get a driver's license, apply for a job, and go to school. The issue was that the federal government wouldn't give her a new social security number unless she located her birth certificate and evidence of her real father. The mental health professionals that she went to see believed that she had some sort of amnesia and or suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. She was also interviewed by a Portland newspaper in 1999. She said, quote, I may not know who I was before I was three, but I do know who I am now, end quote. So there was a lot of people on her side willing to help her out, willing to help her, like, discover her identity, right? So a state social worker searched through governmental records to find any evidence of Brianna, her mother, or the man she said was her stepfather. A worker from Indian Health Services looked through national databases of missing children. He even asked her to give blood in hopes of finding a DNA match. There was never any luck. Brianna even took time off school in January of 2000 to visit where she said she had been raised, Daphne, Alabama. A police detective from Daphne spent several days, like, driving her around, hoping she would see something that would jog her memory. But no one ever found any evidence that she even lived there. One possible clue came when she visited a dentist in Portland. The dentist noted to a social worker that he was surprised that Brianna's wisdom teeth had been taken out and that the scars had been healed, which was weird for a 16-year-old girl. Brianna Okay, so she reacted really strongly when the social worker asked her about, like, the dentist's statement. Mm-hmm. So she responded with a 5-page paper, with a five-page letter criticizing those who doubted her story. Quote, "My word means much to me, and when I give my word that I am doing and being as honest and upfront as I can with the information about myself, I mean it," end quote.
Okay.
Brianna talked to Ken about the dentist story, too, and she became angry when he said that maybe the dentist was onto something. You know, maybe there's some water there. She accused him of being the liar and thinking she's not 16. She was like, "How could you say you love me?" By the end of their junior year, Brianna was staying with the Gambetta family. So she's still, you know, a foster kid, right? She's still trying to find her identity. She's still living, you know, going from house to house. Whose son was good friends with Ken. The church family that she had been living with before could no longer afford to keep her. Mm-hmm. So the Gambettas had been treating her like a daughter. They gave her the spare bedroom. They provided her with an allowance of $10 a week. Everything seemed perfect until May of 1999, when Brianna called the police and said that David Gambetta, the father of the household, had been spying on her. And she said that he had put miniature cameras on her, like, lamp and in her room, and he was making videotapes of her as she undressed. Police did a quick investigation and decided that the accusations were groundless, and the Gambettas were like, "Get out." Brianna found a new home with the mother of a police officer, but continued to insist that she was telling the truth. At that point, even her boyfriend Ken doubted everything she was saying, and he started to second guess the other stories that she had told him as well. Brianna Stewart ended up graduating from Evergreen High School in June of 2000. She was planning to go to a community college in Vancouver, and the school over there was allowing her to go with a tuition scholarship, even though she didn't have a social security number. Her boyfriend, Ken, was leaving Vancouver to work at Disney World. He still loved her, but he wished her luck and left. So Brianna spent the summer of 2000 working as a volunteer answering phones for the Ralph Nader presidential campaign. And most of her time was devoted to... During this time, it's her goal to get a social security number, right? She just wants to go to school and live a life. She writes a letter to the governor of Washington asking for help. And then she does some sneaky shit and hires two separate lawyers, one in Vancouver and one in Portland. And the two didn't even know about each other or what the other one was doing. The attorney in Vancouver sued the state to force the Vital Records Office to issue Brianna's birth certificate. And that attorney provided proof like school transcripts and medical records. The other attorney in Portland chose to petition the federal government directly, asking it to issue Brianna a social security number. Note, Brianna agreed to submit a fingerprint test to make sure there was no chance she could be someone else. Mm-hmm. Brianna Stewart's wish was granted in 2001 when the attorney general allowed her to petition for a new birth certificate. All she had to do was appear at a trial in March. This is when things started going to shit. Mm-hmm. 1 week before she was to officially become Brianna Stewart, she was arrested on March 22nd, 2001, on charges of theft and perjury. Why, you may ask? Because Brianna Stewart wasn't who she said she was at all. And that's where we'll pick up in the next episode.
Cliffhanger. No, that's good. So it's a big turn coming. Okay.
It gets better.
Okay.
It gets so much better.
Okay, well, we'll have to wait till next week, I guess. We'll do it a little earlier next week. Well, thanks for listening, you guys. Do you have weird shit in the news?
I do have weird shit in the news.
Good for you. So, I don't have any.
I was going to talk about how... there are tardigrades on the moon now.
Right. Well, there's some rumblings that may be what's going on.
Well, that they're like dehydrated and like.
Right. They haven't found them or anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tardigrades/water bears. You guys should look into that shit. It's quite interesting. Or just watch the Family Guy episode.
They're great.
Where Stewie and Brian shrink themselves to the size of water bears.
Right.
Anyway. So what I ended up choosing was from Nashville, a story from Nashville. A story posted by Alexandra Keen. It's about a police chase that spanned multiple states. And it was a police chase of a kitten-filled car. And the suspect was arrested. So, Clarksville, Tennessee. Okay, so this kid is 19. His name is James A. Pitt. And his fucking...
His mugshot.
He's, like, smiling. He doesn't look 19. He looks like he's maybe 15 or 16. See. Right?
Oh, yeah. He looks like he's, like, 16.
He looks
yeah.
really young. So he stole a white BMW at a rest area off the interstate in Lee Summit, Missouri. I guess he had a girl with him before, but she was dropped off somewhere in Missouri or Illinois. Illinois. I can't believe I just said Illinois. Pitts later led Illinois State Police on a chase in the southern region of the state near I-57 and I-24 interchange. He got away and then he crossed the border, and so the Illinois police notified Kentucky State Police that that's where he was headed. So Sunday, 11:15 a.m., so this was last week, the Kentucky State Police spot the BMW and they try to pull him over, but he keeps driving, and then he crosses the state line again over to Montgomery County, Tennessee, and he eventually crashes the car in Clarksville. Yeah, it's wild that it could happen.
Yeah,
quote.
Yeah.
Oh my god,
crazy.
Yeah, and the kittens and cats that were in the stolen BMW are okay. They are in the care of Montgomery County Animal Care and Control. Fortunately, the owner of the stolen car has already called them and plans on picking the cats up soon.
Nice.
Scared, probably so confused.
I'm so scared for the cats. So I found something. It's not... Well, I guess it's pretty weird.
Okay, I'm excited.
Okay, I don't. Have you heard about this guy? Okay, this French guy. And he's made this, like, but actually flying machine.
No.
Where you can he can, like, hover, like... fucking like 50 feet in the air and stay. No, but seriously, like I'm not joking. Like,
when's
it's
it gonna
real.
Be commercialized?
Well, I think it's probably super expensive and finicky, but it really works. And recently he successfully on the second try crossed the English Channel and became the first to cross the English Channel on a fucking hoverboard, whatever bullshit. And his name is Frankie Zapata. And he did it in just over 20 minutes. Oh, yeah, this thing can go, like, 80 miles an hour, too.
What?
Yeah, so pretty cool and pretty weird.
Send me pics.
Pics or it didn't happen. Thanks for listening, you guys.
Oh, I forgot to do my source.
Oh, your
source. It's super important because it was a very long, really, really dramatic and well-written article from Texas Monthly.
Oh, right, that long-form Texas Monthly.
By Mimi Swartz. And then my other one is a story from The Olympian, but this story won't come in till part two.
Okay.
Cool.
Great.
No doubt.
Well, check out our Twitter.
Check out the Twitter, the Facebook, the Instagram.
All that stuff.
It's late. Thank you guys so much for being patient with us. We love you.
Bye.
Happy Wednesday.
Bye.
Bye.